This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Neil Conan is away. When the Gallup organization asked Muslims around the world what they admired most and least about the West, then posed the same question to Westerners, both groups gave the exact same answer. This hour, we'll hear exactly what those answers were. We'll also learn how people in the Muslim world view democracy, radicalism, women's rights, and more. Those subjects are all part of the new book, Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think. It's based on the largest ever survey of Muslim attitudes around the world. Later this hour, competing views on why Latino voters tend to favor Hillary Clinton over Barack Obama. But first, our guest is Dalia Mogahed. She's the senior analyst and executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies and co-author of Who Speaks for Islam. Dalia, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Ari. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, as I just mentioned, when you asked Muslims and Westerners what they admired most and least about the West, the two groups gave the same answers. So you want to reveal what those answers were?
Sure. What they admired most about the West was Western technology and then Western democracy. And two top responses were common between the two groups. Now, what they admired least about the West, interestingly, was a breakdown, perceived breakdown of family values, of morality. And again, Americans gave the same response as Muslims around the world.
I find that so fascinating. That suggests that there's really much more common ground here than people may think.
Common ground, exactly. That's what we found over and over. Common ground on a love of democracy or democratic values, a rejection of radicalization, and at the same time, valuing both faith and family.
In both worlds.
Absolutely.
I want to get into each of those issues individually in a moment, but first let's talk a little bit about the methodology. This was the largest survey of its kind. It took place over years in many, many countries across the world. How did you do interviews in some of these countries that have more totalitarian, oppressive governments where people may have been reluctant to speak frankly about personal subjects?
That's an important question. Places where it was hardest, interestingly, were the easiest to get into the door.
What do you mean?
So, well, I'll give you an example. We do polling here in the United States. We've been polling like crazy in the elections. And we find that about half our respondents hang up on us. Now we actually do pretty well because our name is Gallup and people have heard of us. So sometimes they talk to us and 50% is actually pretty high. But in places like Iraq, in places like Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, we have about a 95% response rate. People can't wait to let our interviewers in and tell them what they really believe.
Do you have to make particular accommodations, having women interview women, for example, or doing interviews in particular places?
Accommodations are very important, yes. We make sure that we have a group of interviewers that go out. So we have women and men go and find the sampling unit or the household. And yes, women sometimes have to interview women. It depends on the country, of course. We always do local interviewers. People are speaking, of course, in the same language across similar cultures. We also make sure that all our interviews are in-home and face-to-face, so people aren't feeling the pressure of being in a public place. They're also not inhibited or prevented from partaking in the interview because they can't read and write. Everything is face-to-face and in-home so that no one is excluded.
And how could you be sure people were being honest with you, especially when it came to things like criticizing their government or talking about radicalism?
That's a very important question. There's a number of ways that we can tell. First of all, we ask similar questions in different ways, and we compare answers. We also look at some hard data. Things like Transparency International publishes a wonderful report where they rank countries according to their corruption. Well, we asked people all over the world to tell us how much corruption they thought existed in government and in business. And then we did our own ranking according to perceptions within these countries. And the correlation between our ranking and Transparency International was as high as 0.8%. Huh. Or I'm sorry, 0.8, which means 80% correlation. Meaning that even in these places where corruption is high and transparency is low, we're getting a pretty good read.
Okay, well, now that we've got the methodology out of the way, let's talk about the content of this. You mentioned, or I mentioned rather, radicalism. Mm. You found that 7% of the people in the Muslim world you polled subscribe to radical thinking. Tell me what that means.
Well, we just decided to define radicalism as believing that 9/11 was completely justified and having very unfavorable views of the United States. So we made this our analysis tool. We wanted to look at how many people, in fact, agreed with this anti-American terrorist act, and then what made them different from the mainstream.
And what did make them different?
Well, what was interesting is what didn't make them different.
Right, right.
The first finding is what we didn't find. We didn't find a difference in level of religiosity. So the radicals and the mainstream were equal in their religiosity.
In the amount that they worshipped.
Absolutely. So they weren't more likely to go to the mosque. They weren't more likely to say that religion was an important part of their life. What was also a surprise is that the 7% were on average more educated and more affluent than the mainstream.
So it kind of blows out of the water, this idea that radicals are devout, poor, undereducated people, this idea that has sort of pervaded American thinking in the last 7 years.
Absolutely. In fact, what they look a lot more like are traditional revolutionaries. Revolutionaries throughout history, violent revolutionaries, have looked very much like our profile of these radicals. They're more educated, they're more affluent. They're also angry about politics and not necessarily being more pious. So what distinguishes the radicals from the mainstream is politics and not piety.
We're talking this hour about Muslim attitudes around the world with the author of Who Speaks for Islam, Dalia Mogahed. We want to hear especially from our Muslim listeners this hour. Does what she's describing reflect your experience? Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@npr.org. Dalia, you also wrote a lot about women's rights and how women in the Muslim world feel about what we in the West often perceive as a misogynistic culture. Do the women that you surveyed in the Muslim world see their own culture that way?
How do women see their culture? It's complex. On one hand, they say that religion is an important part of their life. They also say that it's the key to progress in the Muslim world. But they are not non-critical of their societies. Their criticism, though, looks very much like their male counterparts. They critique political corruption and stagnation, lack of economic development. They aren't critiquing specific gender-related issues. So while they're not slavishly approving of their own societies, their critique is not along the lines of gender issues.
One of the things I found really interesting that you talk about in this book is women in the Muslim world using Sharia, using Islamic law, to make an argument for greater gender equality. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little about that.
That's a great point, Ari. Yes, we found one of our big surprises, again, was this lack of a difference in terms of the a difference between men and women in their approval of Sharia. What was even more interesting was, while approving of Sharia, they also wanted equal rights. They wanted the right to vote, the right to education, the right to work at any job they wanted. And they looked to Sharia as the source of that empowerment. So when we asked them, what do you actually associate with Sharia compliance? We found that overwhelming majorities of women associated it with justice for women, empowerment of women. The way they read their divine law is as one that promotes progress.
You found that Muslim women generally want equal rights, but they don't want to be like Western women.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that difference for me, if you could.
Sure. We found that Muslim women, as I said, wanted equal rights, and at the same time, interestingly, associated gender legal equality with the West. That's not too surprising. What was interesting, though, is that they were they weren't likely to associate moving toward greater or progress with adopting Western values. So they were saying, we want rights and we think the West has them, but we don't want to adopt Western culture.
So they didn't see Madonna and Britney Spears as the embodiment of women's equality, is what you're saying?
No, they didn't. And that was the interesting part. When we asked them, what do you admire least about the West? They actually talked about what they perceived to be a degradation of women in the popular culture, that they felt that the portrayal of women as the Britney Spears type figures was not equal, and it was actually degradation. So they wanted the equal rights, but they wanted them within their own cultural context.
We've been talking about how women in the Muslim world feel about gender equality, but just briefly, how did the men you surveyed in the Muslim world feel about gender equality?
Well, that was the interesting thing. We actually found that majorities of Muslim men also favored women's rights. Now, albeit with slightly less enthusiasm as the women, but still, majorities thought that women should have equal rights with men and should be voting, working outside the home, and even leading.
Well, we're talking about a new Gallup poll surveying Muslim attitudes around the world. The book is Who Speaks for Islam? It's what 1.3 billion Muslims around the world really think. The author, Dalia Mogahed, is here in the studio with us. We're taking your calls. The number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. Does what she's saying reflect your experience? If you're a Muslim caller, do you find that you feel differently about these issues than what she has described? We'll hear more about Muslim attitudes when we return. I'm Ari Shapiro. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. There are more than 1 billion Muslims across the world, and it's hard to avoid hearing pundits and politicians speculating on what they think on any number of issues. But a new Gallup poll went straight to the source. We're talking with Dalia Mogahed. She's the author of Who Speaks for Islam? What 1 billion Muslims Really Think. Her book is based on that Gallup poll of Muslim attitudes around the world. And we want to hear from our Muslim listeners in this segment. Does what you're hearing from Dalia Mogahed sound like you? Call us at 1-800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And let's go to a caller. This is Basil in Detroit, Michigan. Hi.
Hello. How you doing, guys?
Fine. Go ahead.
Hi, Basil.
Yes, I am American Arab and first generation, and I'm a Muslim as well. And, you know, judging by what she's been talking about, it kind of reflects a lot of the sentiments even by a lot of people in my community here about wanting equal rights for women, education for everyone, for Muslims altogether, and progressive attitudes altogether. But my only contention was I do understand the radical portion in the sense that some of them are more affluent, educated, and it is most of it's politically based and not necessarily religiously based. But I feel like a lot of the people who are suckered into the whole suicide bombing attitude, and that I feel like they kind of sucker in the more, you know, the less educated, the less wealthy, the people who are kind of in the dead-end situations.
Well, Dalia, what do you think? Did that play out in the poll numbers at all?
Well, you know, we're always looking at meta-trends. Of course, there are people in that 7% that do fall in that exact category that you're describing, Basil. So not all of them were rich and educated. We just found that they were more likely to fall in that group, but they certainly also included lower income and less educated people.
And one more quick question. Do you see any themes in general and different attitudes between Arab Muslim countries and non-Arab Muslim countries? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks. We should note that only 20% of Muslims in the world live in the Middle East. When we talk about Muslims in the news, we're often talking about people in the Middle East, but the largest Arab country, the largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly, Ari. In fact, there are more Muslims in India than in the Arab world, which I always think is so fascinating. There were some differences in geographic locations. So the Middle East, right around the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, is where we tended to see the most hostile or negative attitudes, especially targeted toward the United States. But it wasn't really an Arab thing, because when you go to some place like Morocco or North Africa, you just don't find that. So it wasn't really along Arab versus non-Arab. We didn't find any distinctions that way. It was more about distance from some of these hotspots in the region.
There was an issue about governance that came out in the survey that I found interesting. When you asked people about the kind of government that they would like to live under, they said both democracy and Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
We in the West tend to think of Sharia as a sort of totalitarian, strict Islamic rule that we often see as incompatible with democracy. So right. How do these people explain this combination?
The combination, I think, is one of the most fascinating aspects of the study. We did find that people were saying, one, they wanted Sharia as a source of legislation, and they wanted free speech, freedom of religion, and freedom of assembly. They wanted equal rights for women. What that tells us is that Sharia is similar to the Bible. What does the Bible say? Well, it depends on who's reading it and who's interpreting it. Sharia is very much the same thing. It's a body of interpretation. It's a body of principles that today contemporary Muslims are reading to be very compatible with democratic values.
And interestingly, when you asked Westerners whether they would like to see the Bible influence legislation here in the U.S., how do the numbers compare with, in the Muslim world, the percentage of people who wanted to see the Quran influence legislation?
So how does what role for the Bible is what you're asking? That was really a fascinating finding. 57% of Americans believe that the Bible should be a source of legislation. So the majority of Americans actually see a role for the Bible. 9% of that believe it should be the only source. So some commonality between Americans and Muslims around the world.
And compared to the Muslim world, what were the numbers like for those who thought the Quran should influence?
It ranged from Turkey, which is the most secular, actually more secular than the United States in its desire for religious sources, all the way to Egypt, surprisingly, which was a country where the majority wanted Sharia as the only source of legislation.
Let's take another caller. This is Alan in Doha, Qatar. Hi, Alan.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling from halfway around the world.
Yeah, no problem. I'm actually a professor here at Qatar University. And I teach Qatari students every other day. And one of their concerns is about modernization and the rapid speed of modernization, especially in places like here in the Gulf. I was wondering what your speaker found about whether there was any ambivalence towards modernization, what the general feeling was towards economic development and the choices that have to be made, especially with westernization of the culture.
Thanks for the call, Alan. Dalia Mogahed, what did you find in your survey about westernization and modernization?
That's a really important question. We found a complex set of responses to that. So there were some aspects of modernization that people were very excited about. For example, technology. People around the world said they wanted technology, they admire technology. When it came to economic development, same thing, a great deal of enthusiasm, really a desire for capacity building, for job creation. But then the aspects of modernization that many religious conservatives in this country don't particularly like the breakdown of the family or a perceived moral laxness, that was rejected. So really very similar to some conservative Christians in our country. On one hand, love some aspects of modernization. On the other hand, really want to protect their society from other aspects.
What about the Western political agenda and the desire to spread democracy throughout the Middle East and elsewhere? How did the Muslims you surveyed feel about that?
Democracy was an interesting finding as well. We found that people generally said that democracy, greater democracy, would help Muslims progress. When we asked them what they admired about the West, an open-ended question, people would actually say in their own words things like the rule of law, transparency of government, accountability, the very things that we would say are building blocks of a democratic society. But when asked, is the U.S. serious about the establishment of democratic governments in this region, the answer was, in many cases, no. So an admiration of democracy, but a lack of a great deal of skepticism that the U.S. was actually serious about it.
Let's take another call from Abu in Wichita. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment and would like the listeners to know that I'm an Orthodox Muslim, and the majority of Muslims who blow themselves up and kill innocent people, those are the Muslims who they might be, in a sense, saying that they're Muslims, but their actions dictate other things. Excuse me. And those Muslims, they don't follow the proper guidelines of Islam. Like, we don't celebrate birthdays. Those Muslims who blow themselves up, majority of the time they celebrate birthdays. They celebrate saints, and they worship other things other than what they should be worshiping, which is the law.
Abu, thanks for your call. You know, this actually ties in with something that was in your survey, Dahlia, about the percentage of people in the Muslim world and in the Western world who think it is acceptable to kill civilians. Tell me about those numbers and what you found.
What we found was that the American public and Muslim publics around the world were about equally likely to condemn extremism. In fact, Muslims are in some cases more likely to condemn extremism than the American public.
And in this context, when we're talking about extremism, we're talking specifically about whether you think it is ever acceptable to kill civilians.
Right. Specifically about targeting civilians, that Muslims in many countries are more likely than the American public to say that it is unequivocally wrong to target civilians. Now, one thing Abu pointed to is this idea of the suicide bombers not following Islam. And that's, in fact, what we heard over and over when we did our interviews. So when we asked people why they said what they did about 9/11, so those who condemned it, we asked them, why do you say that? In some select countries, the response was very interesting. They talked about the loss of human life, the innocents that were killed, and at the same time, some cited religious prohibitions against murder. So they were saying very much what Ebu was saying, which is our faith prohibits killing civilians. What was interesting is the 7%, when asked why do they say what they do, to justify their condoning of terrorism, they did not use religious language at all. They didn't cite the Quran. They didn't say that it was something that God called them to. In fact, they were using very secular language. They talked about America as an imperialist power. They talked about the United States thinking it can control the world.
Well, the U.S. and the Western world generally have been undertaking this massive project to improve relations with the Muslim world. Based on what you found in this global survey, what can the U.S. and the West do to improve the likelihood of success on that project?
Well, we asked that very question, and the number one response was respect Islam and stop looking down on Muslims. Muslims have this around the world in places like Turkey, all the way to places like Saudi Arabia, whether they're secular or have a secular government or they have a very religious government, believe that the West does not see Muslims as equal, that they don't really respect them as being just as good.
Well, what does that mean in real-world terms in policy? I mean, how does one that kind of respect?
That's a question we get over and over. It's a complex question because on one hand, it does mean things like not using certain language. For example, Islamofascism is probably not very productive in this kind of a discussion. At the same time, it doesn't just mean language or PR. It probably also includes their perception of policy. So we find that Muslims around the world admire what we'd call American values. They admire things like American democracy and say that America is, in fact, the greatest symbol of democracy in the world, more than other Western democracies like France or Germany. But at the same time, they perceive that these values that we think are inalienable to us are not good enough for them. And so this disconnect between what they see as our espoused values and how we treat them, this perception that they're not being treated according to our values, creates this sense of being disrespected.
I was surprised that even after this project that the U.S. has undertaken to bring democracy and connect with and outreach to the Muslim world, when you ask Americans what they admire most about Islam, the most common answer you received was either nothing or I don't know.
Yes, exactly.
It sort of suggests that whatever these projects have been for the last 7 years, they're not working as well as we might have hoped.
They're not. The interesting thing was that shortly after 9/11, we asked Americans what they knew about Islam and Muslims and their views and values. And we found that 54% said they knew either nothing or not much. That's not very surprising. Pre-9/11, Islam was and Muslims were essentially invisible in the public square. Then in early 2007, we asked the same question. Now, this is after two wars, a great deal of media coverage on Islam and Muslims. And this time, 57% said they knew either nothing or not much. So whatever information is out there, it doesn't seem to be really hitting at the core of these issues.
We're talking with Dalia Mogahed, author of Who Speaks for Islam? This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to another caller. This is Abdul from Manchester, Connecticut. Hi, Abdul.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Abdul. My wife is a Christian. I'm a Muslim. We're both from Ghana. And I think the problem with America is a lot of people, the public, is kind of ignorant about Islam, I think. My wife understands Islam because part of her family are Muslim. And we live together in peace, and I do a lot of good stuff because, you know, it's my religion that guides me to do those stuff. And she does the same, which is pretty much similar, both in the Christian way and the Islamic way. And we can understand each other because Ghana is diverse, and you can have, most of the time you have a Muslim and a Christian running for president and the vice under the same umbrella, the same in Nigeria and stuff like that, which is something I think Americans don't think it happens in other part of the world.
Okay, thanks for your call, Abdul. Dalia, this seems to fit in exactly with what we were just saying, that there is not enough understanding, really, between the two cultures. Proximity, as Abdul was saying, seems to create that understanding, but when you don't have proximity, what's the next best thing?
Well, the next best thing is probably humanizing media. So one interesting finding is that when we ask people about the American government, we get extremely negative perceptions. So we have only about 5% that say that the American government is friendly. They're called aggressive. They're called easily provoked. But then when we ask people about the American people, we get very different answers. So one survey actually found that 90% of respondents said Americans were friendly. What's interesting is that most of these people have never met an American, and yet they think they're friendly. Well, how do they know they're friendly? Because they've met them on TV. And it's the power of humanizing media. The other way around, though, does not exist. We don't have very much Muslim-created or humanizing media on Muslims, and as a result, there's that lack of proximity.
Do you see any positive steps in that direction, shows that are beginning to portray more well-rounded Muslim characters or images of Muslims that don't fit the typical stereotype?
There is a growing interest, which is really interesting and surprising, in the Hollywood community, actually, that want to create more humanizing, more nuanced, more accurate pictures of Muslims. So some examples is The Kite Runner, I think was a great movie that did just that. Aliens in America was a new show that had a Muslim protagonist. So there is a little bit of that. There just needs to be a lot more.
Well, Dalia Mogahed, this is a fascinating book, and thank you so much for coming into the studio to talk with us about it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Ari.
Dalia Mogahed is Senior Analyst and Executive Director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies and co-author of Who Speaks for Islam. She joined us here in Studio 3A. Coming up, Hispanic Democrats have tended to favor Senator Hillary Clinton over Senator Barack Obama. We'll hear two views on why next. I'm Ari Shapiro. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.